I am delighted to introduce to you Sidewalk Tree and Ralph Carter.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, May 28th, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many of the places. He is also the Master of Ceremonies at the Theater World Awards. So, Peter, welcome back from London.
Aren't you nice? Thank you. And speaking of the Theatre World Awards, I am going to say that anybody who is listening who is going to be in New York on Monday, June 5th at 6:30 p.m., please email me privately at pfilichia@aol.com. And if you'd like to attend the Theatre World Awards, I think I'll be able to get you in. So I hope I'll see some smiling faces in the audience who listen to the podcast.
At the Imperial, so will the Theatre World Awards also provide pierogies?
No, that's where we draw the line.
Okay. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So, Michael, you are up and running with a fast new computer. You sound especially good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. So last week, Jan talked a little bit about Pacific Overture as a classic stage company. And Michael, you got a chance to see it. Peter has also seen it. So, Michael, why don't you give us your view on Pacific Overtures?
I got to it very late just because of other conflicts and various things. But Mark Thibodeau was good enough to put me in. Apparently, the show's running to June 18th. So I saw it this past week. And I had, I would say, mixed feelings about it. I do not know the show like the back of my hand, as so many other people do. So in terms of the cuts and the edits, I wasn't as upset by them as other people are. That said, I do remember from the previous one production that I saw and also the recordings that Chrysanthemum Tea was always a highlight for me. So I'm not really sure why that was cut. I think there was some argument made that it's not part of the actual main narrative, but you could say that about several other songs in the show that they thankfully did not cut. So I don't know why John Doyle made that decision. The other negative I would say is that I have to say, I think this is one of those cases where the show is done in modern dress. And you can use all kinds of justifications and say, oh, well, you know, we're looking at it, you know, from a modern day prism, even though the events are, you know, 100 or more years old and blah, 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 blah. But I don't know. I think the main reason is just to save money. And I don't think that that's a good idea in this case to have modern dress because of the very subject that the show covers. And the original production, I believe, did have modern dress only in the final scene for the song Next, where we kind of see Japan coming forward to the what was then the present. I'm sure not everyone agrees with me, but I thought that having modern dress for this show about events that took place many, 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 many years ago was not a good idea. Interestingly enough, the costumes are credited to Anne Hould Ward. So I suppose that they were designed, even though a lot of them just look like things that people would wear off of the street, or maybe she coordinated those costumes. And there are some other elements, such as beautiful long sashes that people wear and things of that sort at a certain point. But anyway, that was my other major negative. Other than that, I think the cast is extremely strong. It's always great to see George Takei on stage. And certainly I would say his material was stronger here than Allegiance. So that was a definite plus. Everyone was wonderful. Anne Harada, of course, Orville Mendoza, and some people who are fairly new to me, including this fellow named Carl Joseph Coe, who played fisherman, American admiral, and first sailor. He was really great. And several other exceptional voices and actors in the company. But the other major positive of this production was Jonathan Tunick's incredibly beautiful orchestrations for nine players. It sounded incredibly full for that amount of people. Of course, it helps that the theater where CSC performs is not that large. But I really, really loved the orchestrations. And between the orchestrations and the quality of the singing, that would have been reason enough to see this production if you can get there before the closing. I highly recommend it, if only for those two things. And, there's a lot of strong staging, some wonderful stage pictures as well by John Doyle. So, with those caveats that I mentioned, I would still highly recommend it.
Okay, Peter, what did you think?
First off, I'm amused that Michael said that Jonathan Tunick arranged for nine musicians, because I'm immediately thinking Jonathan Tunick also orchestrated Nine, the musical, but that's another story, isn't it? I like the production quite a bit. When one goes to CSC, one knows that the theater is not a large one, and so it's going to be on a small scale. So coming in with that information, it's going to make a tremendous difference in our expectations. So I wonder what would have happened had Pacific Ocean opened in a different year instead of the Chorus Line year. Chicago didn't win a single award that year, and if that didn't win, Pacific Overture certainly would have a much tougher time. Though Pacific Overture did win for sets and costumes, I believe. If memory serves, it may not, but that's what I remember. But anyway, this to me is the most astonishing of all the Sondheim musicals, among the many astonishing Sondheim musicals, because this was the toughest one to do. And I'm sure that many of us who are not musicologists have no idea how complicated this score is. Look how he's taking one chord and making tiny variations on it. Notice that change of rhythm. Ah, those Japanese scales, intonations, and minor pentaton. You know, we don't know this stuff, those of us who are not musicologists. So, but it's such a maverick show because it doesn't have a love story per se. Yes, there's a couple that's married, though that doesn't last very long. I won't say why. But in many ways, it's an emotionless show, but never looks to tradition where Sondheim is concerned. And so it's amazing that what he did. So I guess we all know the story by this point about how Admiral Perry showed up one day on Japanese soil. That was in 1853, and they didn't want him on Japanese soil. They really felt that he would corrupt the soil. I mean, this is the ultimate in terms of people having absolute disrespect for others, because they actually put down mats on the soil so that they wouldn't corrupt the soil, and as they would burn the mats afterwards. So that's really saying we'll never confuse that with Southern hospitality, will we? So on the other hand, that Perry claimed he was making Pacific overtures, meaning peaceful ones, but it didn't quite work out that way. And you know, Tevye talks about you, one little thread you pull out, and the rest all pulls out. You know, so that's really what's going on here. The British, the Dutch, the Russian, the French come calling, and you know, that's usually the second act opener when they show up. But here, it's not, because there's no overture. Intermission whatsoever. So, but yeah, how many times do we get a chance to see this? It's very, very rare, and it always will be the rarest Sondheim show from the 70s that will be revived. So I say, really, this is truly worth a trip to New York, depending on where you live. I'm not going to say if you're listening in Jordan right now that you should get on a plane. But if you're within striking distance of New York, you really should take the opportunity. No, it's not perfect. No. But, you know, I think we should take what we can get. I met one of my readers who said, if they're going to do it that way, they shouldn't do it at all. I disagree. If they're going to do it, we have to pay attention, because we don't get it that often.
And, you know, Peter, a few weeks ago, you were extolling John Wideman, I think, when we were talking about Assassins.
Oh, yeah.
And you made the point, and I amplified it actually last week. I have decided that he really was one of Sondheim's best collaborators. And this is another example of that. I kind of wish they had written more together.
And yeah.
I suppose it's still possible.
Yes, I suppose it still is. That said, isn't it amazing that Sondheim, at that point in his career, you know, companies behind him, Follies, Little Night Music, you know, all he won Tonys for all those. He's an established guy. I mean, even if you just relied on your gypsy West Side Story and Funny Thing laurels, working with this kid out of Harvard. Mm. I mean, it's just amazing that he took it on. So how many people in his position would say, oh, please, I'm not going to work with a rank amateur. What has he done? What, a hasty pudding show? Come on. You know, and really, this is quite a tribute to him that he would take him on as a collaborator, and obviously it worked out, because you say they did other shows, and really we have to applaud him for that bit of humanity as well. We often hear about Sondheim being this cold, unemotional guy, but when it came to doing a show, he certainly showed that he could be a real human being in not being condescending to this guy and making it happen.
Well, also when it comes to, as you know, supporting young talent in other spheres through education and other
young playwrights festivals. Sure.
Yes,
sure.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So so really the old expression to give back Sondheim certainly has. But yes, this is the ace trump in terms of that, because how many people would have wanted to work with Sondheim after those three shows? And look who he chose.
Yeah.
So, Peter, what you had said before about if you're in Jordan and you want to maybe this might be the one for you. I wanted to head off into a different direction and share with you an email that I got from one of our listeners named Lewis, who has been traveling around the world and listening to our podcasts. And he's in Paris for the next 4 months. And he had mentioned to me that on your recommendations, he came into New York City in April and saw Dear Evan Hansen, Come From Away, Oslo, Sunset Boulevard, Eugene Onyenkin at the Met. Was that Michael? Did you do that?
Michael. Yeah, Michael.
Eugene Onyenkin.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the French thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And
we're waiting for you, Michael, to give us the pronunciation. You're the opera buff.
And so he wanted to pass along his thanks to you guys for the recommending the shows that he should see when he gets into town, which we have a lot of listeners that are not in New York City and use this as a good recommendation point for getting their tickets, and Lewis wanted to thank you guys. So. And he's in Paris for the next 4 months, so we'll feel bad for him, right?
Yeah. You know?
So thanks, Lewis.
When I go over there, I'm staying with him. Are you kidding?
All right.
They charge hotels in Paris.
Oh, I know. My goodness. Yep. All right. Next up, Peter, you got over to see The Boy Who Danced on Air at the Abington Theater Company's June Havoc Theater. So tell us about that.
This is a pretty fascinating show. Okay, so it starts with a shadow play type of thing. And it's very effective because it's between an older man and, let's say, a teenage boy. Okay, and the older man is shown as if he's 10 feet tall, and the boy is shown as if he's 3 feet tall. He's not a boy now, really. A teenager is probably more apt. Okay. And as it turns out, we're in Afghanistan. And the older man says that he has bought this boy from his parents. Forget your father. He doesn't exist anymore. I'm your father now. And you think, uh-oh, this is going to be a sexual thing. You know, that's why he bought him. And then he says, you know, I'm going to train you to be a great dancer. You think, oh, this is wonderful. This is, you know, like Diaghilev and Nijinsky. Oh, you know, this is, oh, isn't that wonderful? Here we were. Look at us thinking it was going to turn out to be a sexual thing. Shame on us. Here's an altruistic man who sees potential in a boy, and he's going to make him a dancer. Wonderful. Then he points out that in Afghanistan, you really have to have great respect for women, and you do not do anything sexual with women until they're married to you. And then, of course, you know, you can have children, and that's very nice. But you can't do anything with women. So, you know, the value system there is very strict about women, and they revere women, and there's something nice about that, too. Then he points out that because a man has urges, and he can't use them on women because, again, is what the reason I just gave, boy, you're going to be the person in which I get my sexual urges out. So there we were. We were tricked into thinking he was altruistic, and now we're not tricked at all. But we were tricked for a second there. And so where is this show going to go? And it really takes us for a very big surprise a few minutes later. In fact, I thought I heard incorrectly when CNN is mentioned. And then a person pulls out a cell phone. Wait a minute. You mean this is happening now? We get the impression this is Afghanistan of long ago when these terrible things happened between men and boys. No, it's happening right now. And it is based on a documentary. The writers, Charlie Schoen and Tim Rosser, really saw this documentary, which I'm told is on YouTube, and were pretty flabbergasted by it and said, this is our next musical. So twists and turns occur. And while this is hardly perfect, and while some of it seemed to be a first draft, it's not. It's been around. It's played in California. This really is a show that's compelling in so many instances that I do believe attention must be paid. The Abington Theater is a cluster of very small theaters. I doubt if there are 99 seats in the house. So maybe you'd want to get there sooner rather than later and make sure you get in, because it's very well performed, very nicely directed by Tony Speciale, who I believe is now the artistic director there. And good for him for bringing such a tough piece over. Mm-hmm. I will say that something happens to the boy that makes him... how can I put this? It's so hard to do without spoiling it, but the boy tries to compensate for something terrible that happens to him, and it's one of the most moving, silent sequences in the show. I'm being purposely enigmatic. I want you to go see The Boy Who Danced on Air, and while you won't rate it 5 stars, you'll certainly give it quite a few stars.
All right. Michael, you got over to the Vineyard Theater to see Can You Forgive Her? Can you tell us about what you thought?
Yes, I alluded to the show last week because it hadn't opened yet, but now it has. This is a play by Gina Gianfrido, directed by Peter Dubois. And I won't say too much about it other than to add what I mentioned last week. This is a play that shows a tremendous amount of talent on the part of Gina Gianfrido. I think she's especially good at dialogue, writing really entertaining dialogue, and she can be very, very funny. Let me just give you a basic plot summary here. There's a woman named Tanya, played by Ella Dershowitz, and she thinks she might want to marry this fellow named Graham, played by Darren Petty, but she also thinks she might not want to marry him because she's concerned about his business prospects. He seems like a wonderful guy who really loves her, but he doesn't seem like the most ambitious fellow in the world. And so she's basically grilling him in the first scene about what he's planning to do. And, you know, I think you should do this with your life, and, you know, you need some direction and blah, blah, blah. And then when he agrees to do what she wants, then she accepts his proposal. So the basic point of the play is what people do, and I guess specifically what women do, how they balance finding someone who's a good provider. If they're planning to not be in the business world or whatever themselves, and if the women are planning to look at marriage as in the old way of marrying a good provider, how do you balance that against someone that picking someone that you really love, and which is more important? So those are two of the characters. Another character is this woman named Miranda, played by Amber Tamblyn, who is just maybe like a step up from a prostitute. She really just goes from guy to guy, according to how much cash they have. And she's a really interesting person. Then also in it is our friend Frank Wood, who was on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he's brilliant as always. And then there's one more character played by an actor named Ishan Bey. Oh, I won't go into that because there would be a little bit of a spoiler there. But my main problem with this play, as I mentioned last week, is that it seems to me that the tone keeps shifting. For example, the first scene between Tanya and Graham seemed really quite realistic. So I was buying into the play on that level. But then all kinds of weird things start to happen, including at one point, one character shows up in a Michael Myers mask. So I won't get into the details, but I just was a little confused as to what the tone of this play was in general and what level of reality we were supposed to be dealing with. And so that I think, to me, that's a flaw in a play if the audience is confused about that. Others would say no, it's just a new freedom in playwriting, so that's a matter of personal taste. But that's what I felt. I do regardless think that Gina Gianfrido has a tremendous amount of talent, and I hope to see more of her work in future.
Okay. So that's Can You Forgive Her at the Vineyard Theater. I have a link to the Frank Wood interview from this week on Broadway on April 30th in the show notes if you want to take a listen to that. We had a great time talking with Frank. So, Peter, you got a chance to get over to Signature Theater's production of Susan Laurie Parks' Venus. Even though it is sold out and not a ticket to be had, tell us what you thought so that people can possibly see it if it pops up somewhere else.
Is that true? Wow. I have to say there were empty seats when I saw it yesterday. That may just mean people weren't showing up. But for the record, maybe that means that you can get in through cancellations, and I hope you can. All right. So here we are with Venus, which is about the Venus Hottentot. Not unlike the Elephant Man, woman had from Africa had a tremendously large set of buttocks and was considered a freak, was taken to a freak show in England, and was seen by one and all virtually naked. Certainly her breasts were exposed. The actress who plays the role doesn't have to worry about that because she is in a suit specially made to indicate that she is naked. In fact, ironically enough, there's a sign outside the theater, which I have never seen anywhere before, talking about the simulated nudity you will see. It's kind of interesting, because simulated nudity, is that something really people have to be warned about? Well, who knows? Anyway, so Zainab, Z-A-I-N-A-B, Ja, is the girl who plays the Venus Hottentot, and she's spectacular in it. It's a very tough role. But anyway, she's taken there, and she's a freak. The thing is, I'm not saying the Elephant Man was not a bright man, but this girl is extraordinarily bright, extraordinarily. And it's wonderful to see this, that here's a person who is much smarter than the people who are attending to her. First, a woman who buys her and exhibits her, and then a man who claims he loves her and takes her to Paris. Does he love her? Well, at one point when she says to him, "Do you love me?" He says, I would give my life for you. Sometime later, do you love me? I'm here, aren't I? Very, very clever writing there to let us know the difference. Also, there's a situation where at the beginning, when a person says, I'm taking you to England, this is in the first act, she said, what's England? Then when the guy says, I'm taking you to Paris, she says, what's Paris? And that's a very effective way of showing she hasn't been allowed to learn very much. But, oh, is she bright? I wonder how much her brain weighs. Well, her brain weighs 38 ounces, according to Susan Laurie Parks. God forbid that she could tell us what the average weight of a brain is. That doesn't mean anything to us, that her brain is 38 ounces. So when I got home, I checked, and the average brain is 3 pounds, which is 48 ounces. But I'm telling you, what's packed in that 38 ounces is really quite impressive. Now, what Michael just said about his playwright is much more true here. The play takes place in 1810. And there's a reference to jet lag. There's a reference to Fort Knox, which, again, research teaches me, started in 1861. And I'm not sure English people would be talking, or Parisian people, I don't remember which it was, would be talking about Fort Knox anyway. And everything's coming up roses, as mentioned twice. And Stephen Sondheim truly believes that he's the one who came up with that expression in the late 50s. So it does take you out of the play. And when such liberties are taken with language, you start wondering what other liberties have been taken. Now, of course, we all know that every playwright has a poetic license when it comes to historical facts, that you can't tell everything exactly as it happened, that you have to cut, you have to adapt, all that kind of stuff. But when such liberties are taken with the language, what other liberties have been taken? How true is this story? We do have to wonder. Oh, there's a two-headed woman in the sideshow who says, I freak out. I guess that's supposed to be a funny part. I don't know. But anyway, still, I find it quite interesting that the play is called Venus and not Venus Hottentot. And I suspect the reason is because Venus is associated with beauty, and Venus Hottentot is another thing entirely. And I think Susan Laurie Parks wants to see that this was a beautiful person. She is a beautiful person. And it's really a tragedy that, once again, a metaphor for our times, you know, if you don't have the body that people admire, you are going to be castigated for it. You're going to be shamed for it, and you're going to suffer a lot. And it's amazing how well this woman does under those terribly arduous circumstances. For me, it was the most engrossing Susan Laurie Parks play I've seen. And that should make Susan Laurie Parks fans very interested in it, because, of course, she has had such wonderful success through the years. That said, I will also point out, to balance that, there's a point in the play when the doctor, that's who he is, the guy who takes her to Paris, says, go to sleep. And wouldn't you know, just then from the audience came out a large snore from a guy who didn't stop snoring for the rest of the show. So it may not impress everybody, but it certainly impressed me.
All right. So that is also, I have a link to that in the show notes. It's a Signature Theater's production of Susan Laurie Parks' Venus at the Signature. So, Michael, next up, you got over to the Astoria Performing Arts Center where you saw Raisin. So tell us about that.
Well, Raisin, I'm so glad I got to see it, because this is the first time I've ever seen it, and who knows, it may be the last. It was a Tony Award-winning musical version of Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. The book for the musical is by Robert Nemiroff and Charlotte Zaltzberg, music by Judd Wolden, and lyrics by Robert Britton. And I, judging from this production, I think that it's a very solid musical, and I am not sure at all why we don't see it more often. Maybe Peter can offer some theories on that. This was a wonderful production in the sense of the talent that was gathered. Specifically, the woman who played Lena Younger, Ebony Marshall Oliver, was really phenomenal. And but also Brandy Knox as Ruth Younger, Sarita Amani Nash as Benita, and young Chinua B. Payne as Travis. And The issue here is that about 2 years ago, the Astoria Performing Arts Center got a new artistic director, and I'm not sure if this person directs all of the shows that they do now, but he directed Merrily We Roll Along, which I saw last year, and he directed this production of Raisin. And I have to say, I really don't think he did a very good job with either one of them. For example, in this production of Raisin, Walter Lee Younger is played by Warren Nolan Jr. And at first I thought, well, he's really not a very good actor at all, although he had a wonderful voice from the top. But then later on, and especially in Act Two, he had some really, really great scenes. And in fact, he was at his best in what I would think would be the more difficult scenes in the piece, which is the opposite of what I noticed when Denzel Washington did the role in the non-musical version, the original play. So I think that Warren Nolan Jr. would have been really, really great in the whole performance if he had had a director who had helped him a little bit. And the reason I think it's a director because there were some other issues, including some very, very questionable staging. The whole concept of the set was that it was a unit set where the that is basically the apartment that the Youngers are trying to get out of to move into their new home in Clybourne Park. And that's fine to have a unit set. But the way that it was used in the scenes that are not supposed to take place in the apartment was very, very poorly done. Also, people kept climbing up on top of tables and chairs during the musical numbers. And my friend and I, the friend with whom I saw the show, and I were very, very nervous that somebody was going to fall. So I know the reason that this was done, I can pretty much guess, is because the stage was relatively small and they didn't know how to get those set pieces off for the musical numbers. But I'm sorry, figure out a way. Don't put them on top of tables and chairs. Choreography, by the way, by Tamron Goldberg. And then there were a couple of other things that indicated the director was really not doing a very good job. Although this Chinua B. Payne was extremely adorable and very charming and compelling and very good actor overall, he had a thing that he kept doing where he kept looking into the audience. So I think that maybe a better director might have made him understand how important it was not to do that. So I hope that not to get into it, but here is a director who boasts in his bio in the program about how many New York IT awards he has been nominated for and that he's won two of them. And if I understand correctly, these are among several awards, too many awards, that basically have no credibility in my view because of the way that they're voted on. Anyone can vote for them. I think you can vote multiple times, et cetera, et cetera. You can vote for something you haven't seen. You don't have to prove that you saw it in any way. So I'm sorry, but I really don't like that. So I hope that maybe they revisit their artistic director or that they let someone else direct some of the shows. And I think that would really help because I remember before this person came on, I saw at least two really excellent shows at APAC. One was Children of Eden several years ago. And then they also did a really nice production of The Secret Garden. So that's my hope for that company. And it might be something for them to look at.
All right. So, Peter, you got a chance to see a musical called Farmer Bro. Is it? I don't really know much about this other than you mentioned that you saw it.
I understand that.
So is this Martin Tricchelli? Oh my goodness. Yeah. So you saw it at the Player Street down at McDougal Street. So tell us about Farmer Bro.
That's Pharma, in case anybody thought that you were saying Farmer. So, based on a true incident that many of our listeners may know about, Martin Shkreli, the terrible human being who raised a piece of medication from something like $1,350 a pill to $750 a pill, has a lot of money, and he's very free with his money, to the point of which he took an offer that a rap group named Wu-Tang made. They were going to make an album. They were going to make one of them. So this is, as the person in the play says, there's only one Mona Lisa, and now there'll be only one Wu-Tang album, and we'll put it up for auction, and we'll see who gets it. So this enticed Martin Shkreli, who wanted to stress the fact that he has so much money, and what better way to do it than to buy this rap album. He's a rap fan, frankly, so it's not as if he went out on some sort of artistic limb here. I mean, he knew their other albums, he liked their albums, and so he wanted to be the one person in the world to have it. And Bill Murray gets involved because he doesn't want him to have it. So we do have a conflict here. This sounds like junk, and it is not. On its own terms, this is a very successful musical, and it's got a rock score that may not live for the ages, but you know what I'm going to say next? I was very impressed that the craft is very good. Everything rhymes. and I did not expect that for a tenth of a second from a rock musical of this scope in a small theater with three musicians, a rather large cast, actually, about 10 people in the cast, maybe more, maybe one less, but the number nine is coming up a lot today. Anyway, I have to say that this 85-minute show, maybe, no intermission, had me interested every step of the way. And the actor playing Martin, his name is Patrick Swales Caldwell, is extraordinary beyond belief. He is so smart in the way that he exudes smarminess. We're supposed to hate this guy, and this guy makes it very easy for us to do it. He's got this grin that you want to not just wipe off the face, but you want to get a plastic surgeon in there to sew his lips together and completely change it. More to the point, most of the time, I would see at least 80% of the show, and I bet I'm low, he's on a hoverboard. He doesn't walk. He zooms around the stage on this hoverboard, and he's extraordinarily adept at it. So this is another hurdle that he had to jump, and he does it beautifully. I started thinking, you know, people took a lot of issue with A Little Mermaid with the people on skates, which I thought were fine, but maybe hoverboards is the answer. If you're doing Little Mermaid, consider it if indeed you have people who are good at it. So the actor playing Bill Murray, his name is John Bander, doesn't look like Bill Murray, but he captures his spirit very nicely, and his voice, more often than not, sounds like Bill Murray, so that's good. So I'll tell you, we've had anti-heroes over the years. We've had Pal Joey, we've had Sammy Glick and What Makes Sammy Run, and of course Sweeney Todd. But now we have Martin, who joins the group, and it's a strange show to recommend, and I will tell you, if you're offended by the F-bomb, well, if the F-bomb really were bombs, there would be no more Greenwich Village, because I'm telling you, that word is, I'm sure, the word used more even than ah and the in this show. So keep that in mind. If you're offended by that, this is no place for you. In fact, there's even a song called I'm Martin F-bomb Shkreli. And but the whole theme of power corrupts, and you give enough person enough money, you are certainly going to create somebody who will become a monster, and we've certainly seen that in other areas of our lives. So here we are with Farmer Bro, and I recommend it warily, but I have to recommend it.
I can't remember, and not that it really matters, but what was the drug? What was the illness that the drug?
I don't know either. No, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was something major. It wasn't AIDS, was it? But it was something.
No, I don't think so.
No, but it was so. It was something really, like, really important.
yeah. And little did he care. So, I'm told he's the most hated man in America, and that's quite a thing to be able to achieve, because God knows there are plenty of other people we can hate. But still, you know, this guy certainly has to be right up there and deserves to be. So so you might not even want to spend time with this guy under those circumstances. But I'll tell you, I'm not sorry for a tenth of a second that I saw the show.
It looks like it was an anti-parasitic drug. I can't find it quickly here, but it says it's basically it's used to treat an estimated 2 billion people.
Yeah.
2 billion. And, wow. And he raised the price the price here from $13.50 to $750 per pill, just as Peter had mentioned. Peter, a quick few things about this. Bill Murray's making quite an impact on the New York theater scene this year, isn't he?
Yeah.
With Groundhog Day and Farmer Bro. Yeah. And the hoverboards, I think that, you know, as you mentioned, he had that look on his face that you just wanted to smack off of it. And it's the same look that most people driving around New York City on hoverboards has on their face. I really want to hit them. And I don't know what... they could have topped it off with a bottle flipper. Have you seen people that flip the water bottles to try to stand them up and annoy people?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Good Lord.
Oh, boy.
One outrage after another.
Just to a little sorbet to cleanse the palate. You just got back from London, where you saw a few things. So tell us about your trip to London.
Okay, the show that I liked the best was The Girls, which is a musical version of Calendar Girls. You may have heard of this because there was a movie, and then there was a stage play. It didn't come here, but it did play London in the West End. So this is about a group of women who are friends. They belong to the same club. The club is very boring, but they go anyway. And one of the women has a husband who is terribly, terribly ill. And we see a scene where she goes to the hospital and she sits down on a couch. And I guess a spring is poked through the fabric. And so when she sits down, she sits on it and she's very uncomfortable. It happens again. The next time she goes to the hospital, and this is where it should be a song, because this is a big event in what's happening in this show, because her friends decide they are going to raise some money to replace the couch in the waiting room. So since this is – we don't get the impression that it's anything more than a minor annoyance when she sits on it, and because it's going to be significant, I think we do need her to sing a song about this couch. Every time I come here, no matter where I sit on it, you know, I get poked, you know, so on and so forth. So how are they going to raise money? Those who saw the movie Calendar Girls or the play know exactly how they raised money. They decided to do a calendar where they pose nude. Now, these are not women whose bodies would launch 1,000 ships, and they know it. And convincing some of them to do it, I mean, they need 12, is going to be hard in this very staid women club. But do what they do. Now, there are other complications, of course, because what do the men in their lives, and that includes a son, what do they feel about what's going on here? Are they going to be terribly embarrassed by this? It's easy to think that they would. So under those circumstances, we are talking about a lot of conflict. And what's wonderful about the show is the heart that's in it. Beautiful heart, that these women are such good friends that they would go to these extreme lengths to make it happen. Now, it does remind us of another show that started as a movie as well. That, of course, is The Full Monty. Now, notice when The Full Monty came over here, it was an Americanized version. Suddenly, it was taking place in Buffalo and not in England. If The Girls were to come here, I think it could profit by the same thing if it were Americanized. Matilda got away with it, yes, indeed, by not Americanizing it. I think Matilda would have been far more successful had it been Americanized, as the film version of the original story was. So, but the one thing that this show does, The Full Monty did not, is you do see a good deal of flesh. And so you have to admire these courageous women who, again, as I say, are not conventional beauties and are not young women. To be able to do this. And while we're not talking about full frontal nudity, we're talking about breasts more than anything else, or strategically placed hands over certain parts of the body. The fact remains that you see far more than you would in The Full Monty, where the lights suddenly get very bright at the end of the show. So I hope it comes here. I hope it's Americanized. But even if it's not, I think it's a wonderful musical. I love the music very much. At intermission, I went to the merch counter because believe me, finding record stores in London is impossible now. I went into a bookstore, which also had CDs and DVDs, and I said, where's the section with the shows? And they pointed me to a shelf where I counted 24 CDs from 24 shows, one copy of each, including, of all things, Clinton the musical. I don't know how that got there, but it did. Anyway, back to the merchandise counter. There I was, and they said, no, it's not out. Oh, by the way, they had, you, of course, they said the soundtrack is not out yet, but, you know, what are you going to do? So I didn't get it, and but I'm looking forward to it. It's very bubblegum 60s music, which indeed is right for these characters because that's the music of their youth, and they are, in a way, finding their youth again. The lyrics, craft is good here too, but a lot of imagination. The boy who's embarrassed by his mother is woebegone because he's a virgin. And I'm not going to get this right in the first because it's such a tricky word, but he doesn't say, I'm in monogamy, I'm in nomagamy, meaning he's not getting any. So there's a lot of wit in the lyrics as well. So this is a fine show on a very strange set. It seems to be furniture, seriously, piled atop each other, like two mountains of furniture. I mean that. Painted gray. Who knows why? Anyway, it doesn't seem to have anything to do with it, or I'm missing a point. And I didn't see it when I was jet-lagged and falling asleep or anything like that. So it held my attention totally. So The Girls is the best thing I saw. I would say a couple of other things before we leave London here. I saw Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with the Belle of the Staunton, who was marvelous, and so was the rest of the cast. But there was a funny moment because I don't know how well you know Virginia Woolf, but early in the play, Martha is trying to find the name of the movie she's referencing. She can't think of it. And he says, Chicago. The audience bursted to laughter. And I guess this people are not familiar with Virginia Woolf, and I think they think it's taking place right now. And he's talking about the Rob Marshall movie of the Broadway Candor and Ebb show. So, but anyway, Imelda Staunton's really quite marvelous, especially at the end where she has a long monologue. She really makes it pay off. I was a little wary at the beginning. She wasn't going to be as fine as I thought because she seemed to show a little more love for George than we usually see in the play. But when you think of it, it is a love-hate relationship, so love can come out at any time, and certainly the hate can come out at any time, too. The biggest disappointment, I think, was the miser, you know, because I thought, here in London, they'll do it right. They know how to do Molière. Yeah, he's a French playwright, but still, they're very good with classical theater. So if you're going to see classical theater, here's the place to do it. And 14 seconds into it, I knew I had made a terrible mistake, and I'll tell you why. This was playing at the Garrick Theater in the West End. In other words, it was a commercial production. I wasn't at the Barbican. I wasn't at the National Theater. I wasn't at the RSC. I was at none of those places. I bet if I were there, the Miser would have been done in classical style and would have been a knockout. But here, it was a bastardization of it. I mean, there was talk about trickle-down economics. I rest my case. So that was the biggest disappointment. All in all, as always, it's fun to be in London, even though, of course, it rained every day. But just walking around the West End and seeing all those wonderful theaters and being in them, of course, makes a big difference in a theatergoer's life. So I'm glad I was there.
It rained a lot here, too, if that makes you feel.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Yeah, it did. Peter, I'm surprised that the Albee Estate let Virginia Woolf happen in right. Great Britain with all these English people.
Sure, that's right.
did you happen to hear the scandal when you were over there about the Woolf production in Portland, Oregon?
Oh, as long as I have my iPhone with me, I hear about everything. Sure. The black guy rejected by the state. And I thought the Dramatists Guild really put out a very fine statement on this, in which it said, you know, hey, the playwright's got the right to do whatever he wants. The estate has the right to do anything it wants. At the same time, we encourage non-traditional casting. And I don't think they could have said it any better. It was a perfect response. There wasn't an ounce of fat on the response, and I was really tremendously impressed in them making both points very solidly.
All right. So before we go, I just wanted to mention that the Broadway League put out a very interesting press release last week that said something that I think all of us are going to cheer. It says, Broadway attendance for the 2016-2017 season tops that of all 10 New York, New Jersey sports teams combined.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, let me count, the Yankees, the Mets, the Nets, the Rangers, the Islanders. Giants and Jets. That's seven. The Devils, that's eight. The Knicks. I didn't say the Knicks, I said the Nets, so that's nine. I don't know who the 10th team would be, but all of those teams combined.
Wow.
Broadway,
I wonder if they mean
now.
The soccer. I wonder if the soccer team's involved in that too. One of the plays out.
Yeah, Cosmos.
No, I don't think it's that anymore. Red something.
Red Bull. Red
and
Bull.
They're out. Red Bull is it Red Bull.
Yeah, Red Bull.
Yeah. Okay. And they're halfway between New York and Newark. If you take New Jersey Transit to Newark, or even the PATH train, you'll see the stadium in the distance. So
there is a Broadway connection to Red Bull. Did you know that?
I was just going to say they have a really great production of The Government Inspector now, the Red Bull.
They sure do. With a lot of New York's best talent there. Michael McGraw, Mary Testa, Arnie Burton. Yeah, terrific work. But we're not supposed to talk about it yet, right, Michael?
Not quite yet. It hasn't opened yet. But
even though we both loved it.
We both loved it, yeah.
There is a Broadway performer named Jerome Vivona. Vivona? Do you know Jerome?
Yes.
Who is a professional soccer trainer as well as being a great dancer and actor and things like that, and works for Red Bull, the soccer team. So there's our connection back to there. But just to imagine the scope of all those internationally known teams like the New York Yankees, and that Broadway has sold more tickets than all of those teams combined. So I thought that was...
It's not a new statistic. This happens every year, in fact. But anyway, it certainly is worth mentioning. But it's worth mentioning that it's been happening for a long, long time. Now, you might say, well, you know, I mean, the sports teams don't play 416 times a year. Yeah, but they have bigger stadia than the theaters do. So really, very impressive.
Also, I just wanted to say I always like it when they do these statistics with attendance rather than amount of money, because I know it would be different in this case.
Well,
anyway.
I think next year Hamilton might take it. You know, Hamilton having $3 million weeks every single week. Yeah. It's just I remember when $1 million week was like, whoa.
Yes.
Of course.
And then you look at a show that's so well received and got such a great cast, like A Doll's House, that is doing $300,000 a week or $350,000 a week. And you're like, you know, you would think that a show like that that's being so well received and receiving so many accolades and has such a great cast would be in that $1 million club. But not yet.
Well, I was passing by the theater yesterday while walking to the Signature, and I overheard somebody say, no, it sounds like a musical, but it's not a musical. And I guess A Doll's House does sort of sound like it might be a musical title if you don't know anything about Ibsen. So again, here we are in an era where...
I can't tell you how many times I've confused it. I've said A Doll's Life
talking about this. All right. Now, let me say this. Bertolt Brecht said, in dark times, will there be singing? All right. Now, many of us feel that we are living in dark times in America. So I did a little research, and I found out that there are more musicals playing on Broadway now in any election year since 1928. Remember, the movies are just starting to talk then. So in dark times, will there be singing? There sure is on Broadway during these dark times.
Interesting, really, though, that several of these musicals are quite dark.
Yes.
So for whatever that's worth.
Right. We're living in dark times. No question about that. So it does reflect what's going on. But 1928 is a long time ago.
Yeah. All right. So before we head out of here and talk about trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each time you have an episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to Apple Podcasts for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in Apple Podcasts. You can listen to us in many ways. iHeartRadio plays us. Google Play plays us. TuneIn, Stitcher, many places that you can get your finer podcasts from, as well as Broadway World Radio. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about, can be found at BroadwayRadio.com in our show notes. So, Michael, give us an update on your trivia question from 2 weeks ago.
Well, there's an interesting complication to my question and the answer, which maybe is even more interesting than the question itself. The question had been, what two currently running Broadway shows have more than one scene taking place in the same building? Meaning there's one show that's currently running, one musical that has more than one scene in a certain building, and another show also currently running that has more than one scene in that same building. And no one got it. I got no responses, correct or incorrect. And then I gave the answer, which is Phantom of the Opera and Anastasia, because the building in question is the Palais Garnier, which is the Paris Opera House. And obviously in Phantom, in Phantom, there's more than one scene there. And then in Anastasia, there's a point where some people go to the ballet, which would have been that same building. But after I gave the answer, one of our listeners, Alex Lauer, wrote in and said, I don't know if that's technically correct, because technically, believe it or not, it's in certain places, depending on your source, it says that the action of the Phantom of the Opera is supposed to take place in a fictional building called the Opera Populaire. Now, I do remember that when the movie of Phantom came out, I noticed that change, because there's a scene sequence at the beginning where they show the building, and it's obviously not the Palais Garnier. And so I thought, well, that's weird. And I don't remember if I researched it at the time, but I thought that was just some odd, strange, very weird change made for the movie. I did not research it before I asked my question, but after Alex told me that he thought I was wrong, I looked up on IBDB.com first, and there it says that the action takes place at the Paris Opera House, which is obviously the Palais Garnier. But if you go to certain other places, including the Wikipedia entry for the Phantom of the Opera, it says the Opera Populaire. So I am very, very confused. I don't know why this change would have been made. Also, it seems like it's not even clear that it has been made, because I told this story to a friend and he said, oh, that's ridiculous. When the show originally opened, Andrew Lloyd Webber took Sarah Brightman up to the roof of the Paris Opera House, the Palais Garnier, and they took photos there. And then also there's many other things, like the scene when they're in the boat. That's supposed to be in the lake that's beneath the actual Palais Garnier. So I really don't know. If anyone knows, maybe Peter knows, and maybe he'll tell me right now, if any of our listeners know why this change was made, I would really like to know. It can't have been a rights issue, because you don't need the rights to match to say that something is taking place in the Palais Garnier. I'm just really very, very confused.
You got me, Gaby. You got me. I don't know.
Maybe we should ask Puccini.
I was a little worried there when you said he took it to the top of the Paris Opera House. I thought that story was going in a very different direction, because, you know.
Well, this is before the
right. These were in happier times.
Yeah, happier times. Do you guys know the Yeston Coppet Phantom?
Yeah.
Because the Yeston Coppet Phantom has lyrics in it that talk about the Paris Opera. It doesn't mentions the Palais. So I don't know if it's a modification just in Andrew Lloyd Webber's part, but the original source material, the Gaston Leroux novel, is about the Paris Opera.
And so is the famous 1925 movie, and I think all the other movie. I don't know. I mean, I didn't do exhaustive research on it online, so I will. But if anyone knows, I'd really love to know.
Okay. So, Peter, do you have a new trivia question for us?
Sure. What do these properties have in common? Cats, the Fantastics, A Raisin in the Sun, Starlight Express, and two Chekhov plays, The Three Sisters and Uncle Vanya. Now, you might get a semi-clue from four words mentioned in a row in If They Could See Me Now from Sweet Charity. So play that song and see if you get a semi-clue to what I'm talking about.
All right. So if you have an idea of what Peter's asking, you can email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. Don't forget to email Peter if you would like to attend the Theater World Awards. Peter, why don't you give us that information one more time?
Not PFILICHIA@AOL.com.
And that's only if you're going to be in town on Monday, June 5th.
Monday, June 5th at 6:30 at the Imperial.
Exactly. All right. So on behalf of Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Yes, you let it go. To grow.